Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Amid current debate over immigration and citizenship, a new book from a UNH professor reminds us we've been here before. The book is called Under the Starry Flag. It's about a small band of Irish Americans who raised a big ruckus for Irish freedom and ended up sparking huge changes in U.S. immigration policy. Our guest is the book's author, Lucy Sawyer. She's an associate professor of history at UNH, and let's hear from you, too. We welcome your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Lucy Sawyer, welcome. It's really nice to meet you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
What's the bigger story, Lucy, that you uncovered in looking at this very specific tale of these Irish Americans who joined a revolution in Ireland, basically, or an attempt at revolution, called the Fenian Revolt?
Well, it starts with this mass migration in the 19th century, the beginning of modern mass migration, when about 4.5 million immigrants come to the United States between 1840 and 1860. And what I found out was that there was a huge debate over whether they could even leave their home countries and what happened when they became American citizens and they became claimed by their home countries, whether it be Britain or German states, Prussia. So I had not realized that there were difficulties in actually leaving your home country. And also I had not realized that there was a whole debate about whether you could change your citizenship. So there's a whole hidden story that I had no idea about, and that's what hooked me into the story of the Fenians.
Well, and there's a bunch of themes, as you say. So it's Fenians, not Fenians.
People say it differently. Fenians is what I say, and a lot of other people, too.
Well, so, and before we get into this specific story of these Irish Americans, who, just to tantalize listeners a little bit, really wanted to help this revolt against British rule and gotten a boat and got guns and got money and so forth. But before we get into that, a couple bigger themes that you just mentioned there, Lucy. First of all, the idea that some of the European nations that these massive amounts of immigrants came from were not thrilled to lose young people in their prime working years to America. What did the word expatriation mean during this time period, Lucy, 1840 to 1860?
Yeah, it's a term that people don't know anything about today. So when I first started researching this Expatriation Act of 1868 that the United States passed, I had no idea what it really meant.
It sounds like you're getting kicked out, expatriated.
Right. It sounds like you're forced out, that you're losing citizenship or you're being forced out. But it had a really different meaning in the 19th century. In the 19th century, it meant the right to leave your home, your native home, to move somewhere else, and to change your citizenship. So it meant you had a right to leave Ireland, or you had a right to leave Prussia, come to the United States, and swear your allegiance and become a naturalized American citizen. And this at the time was seen as a natural right. They would call it was a sacred, Americans would say, the right to choose citizenship was a sacred right as natural as the right of free speech, the right to own property, the right freedom of religion. And I think that's something that was so, we don't have that sense today. We've forgotten about this right. So that was what intrigued me, that this was so passionately believed in the 19th century. But today, when I talk about the right of expatriation, I get blank looks. It's a forgotten right.
Well, and how did those Prussian governments, French governments, British government too, how did they feel about all these people coming over to America and renouncing their Prussian or French citizenship and wanting to become Americans?
Well, especially in the 18th and early 19th century, European governments were very concerned. They saw their people as the real wealth of the nation, that they provided the workers, women reproduced the subjects, and men especially fought, you know, that people were the wealth of the nation in some respects. And they really needed soldiers as to be a mighty empire. People started, you know, Britain didn't really care if the Irish left, especially during the famine. They actually helped them leave. But even though they allowed people to leave, they did not believe that they could change their nationality. They argued that they were once a subject, always a subject. Because they were born under the British jurisdiction, they would always be subjects. What this meant concretely for especially people leaving from German states at the time was that it was really hard to leave legally. You had to get an exit permit. You had to jump through all sorts of hoops. You had to show especially that you had served your compulsory military service. And if you didn't show all that, you could not leave legally. So while today we think about undocumented immigrants with an I, the problem of the 19th century where people were leaving without permission, without proper documents, and that would cause them difficulties if they ever went back.
And there are some stories in the book about, I remember a French businessman came back 15 years later, was having dinner with his uncle on business and family, and he got scooped up by the authorities and thrown in prison.
Yep, the gendarmes arrest him and put him in prison, and he's on his way to the French army. And that was really also very much the case in German states.
Let's talk about the Irish, Lucy, because that, again, is the main focus of this book, although, as you said, it's a broader story about immigration, what it means to be a citizen. So these Fenians and the Irish in general, you said that Britain at this point was okay with them leaving. They might still consider the Irish British subjects, but they were okay with the Irish leaving. How come?
Well, Ireland at the time was obviously part of Britain. It was a colony of Britain. The population in before the famine hits, the Irish famine begins 1845, 1846. It had reached 8 million people. And so on the one hand, that seemed to be a good thing if you're thinking about population as being a source of wealth.
Sure, workers and soldiers and so forth, as you said.
But there's a growing concern, especially once the famine hits, about the vast numbers that are dying, that are dependent, that are asking for help. And increasingly, immigration seems to be, for the British government, the answer to this big problem. And even before, the population of Britain is expanding, there is support in Britain for sending out immigrants to reduce the burden of helping the impoverished. There's also some demands in Ireland, especially to modernize agriculture, consolidate farms, make them bigger, more efficient. But that meant you had to get rid of the Irish tenants that were
the small farmers.
The small farmers that were clinging to the land as best they could. So evictions had become more popular, and the British basically supported the immigration of the Irish, thinking that this would help Ireland out in its own way, but also help the Anglo landowners that lived in Ireland and owned the property.
Just to super clarify, Lucy, please. Today, Ireland is its own country, with the exception of Northern Ireland at the top, which a lot of people know is part of Britain. But going further back, when and how did the British control Ireland? Because there's kind of a back and forth there.
Right. It's been a process of conquest, continual conquest, I would say, but especially in the 1700s is when Ireland is firmly under control of England, and it remains a colony. It did have its own parliament, so it did have some degree of independence until the Act of Union in 1800, 1801, where the Irish Parliament is abolished. The Irish are given a certain number of representatives to the British Parliament, but the power is really given, handed over the course of a couple of centuries to the Anglo-Protestants. So Catholics in Ireland are continually losing land, losing power. They're having to support the Anglican Church, even though they're Catholics. So they have been disempowered and disenfranchised in many ways. And so by the 19th century, Ireland is really a colony of Britain, and there is a growing nationalist movement, a growing move for Irish freedom that grows out of this conquest of Ireland.
So you can see why so many Irish people, even before the famine, came over, because first of all, it sounds like Britain didn't really want them. It wanted their land. It wanted them out of the way. Also, just reading your book, Lucy, some of the laws, as you said, they were diminished politically. They were diminished in terms of being able to practice their religion. They were diminished economically because Britain was, again, trying to impose its own version of industrial farming. So even before the potato famine, why wouldn't you come to America?
Absolutely. And there is significant Irish immigration well before the famine, both for political reasons, economic reasons, just like all other immigrants see the United States as being a beacon of economic opportunity. And there's also a great affinity for the United States, especially amongst the Irish who see it as the great republic of the West. So it's an example of the kind of government that many Irish nationalists would like to achieve in their own homeland. So it becomes a model for them.
Let me remind our listeners that they can join us. The number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with historian Lucy Salyer. Her new book is called Under the Starry Flag, How a Band of Irish Americans Joined the Fenian Revolt and Sparked a Crisis Over Citizenship. We'd love your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. So on our side of the Atlantic now, Lucy, how common was it for these new Irish arrivals to become citizens?
It was really common, actually. The Irish naturalized at the highest rates of all immigrants. They have a greater facility for the language. They quickly become engaged in American politics. So they're, I don't know the exact naturalization rates, and it's really hard to tell given the state of the records for this time period. But they really embrace, many of them very much embrace America and American identities as citizens.
So they become citizens. Sounds like it was a pretty easy process from judging the book.
If you were white, it was easy. And if you're a male, it's easy. So that is a huge. Those are two huge qualifications. Under U.S. naturalization law, the Act of 1790 said that any free white person could become a U.S. citizen. You had to live here 5 years. You had to have a couple of character witnesses. And you had to obviously renounce your allegiance to your former sovereign. That was key. And swear your allegiance to support the Constitution in the United States.
So you swear your allegiance, you live here for 5 years, you have a couple people say, yeah, Lucy, she's a good person, oh, except they wouldn't say that about you because it was only for men.
Women could become naturalized, but it was really both politically, because only men could vote, it was really a right that was really seized wholeheartedly by men. Women could naturalize, although their ability to naturalize if they were married shifted over time.
So unmarried women could naturalize. Married women had to go with the immigration status of their husbands.
Exactly.
So all these new immigrants are settling in, coming over, if not before the potato famine, then definitely during and after the famine. And then the U.S. Civil War breaks out. And I was putting myself in their shoes, Lucy, thinking, okay, here I am. I'm a new American. I'm trying to figure it out. This is great. I'm not in Britain anymore. I can exercise my economic and religious rights a little more freely, although, as you write, it's not, you know, all cupcakes and puppies for these new immigrants. How do they feel about their own participation in the Civil War? It breaks out pretty shortly after these waves of immigrants come in.
Yeah. They have mixed feelings about their participation. On the one hand, immigrants are, and their sons, are huge factors in the Union Army. 40% of soldiers fighting in the Union Army are either immigrants or the son of immigrants. So the Union Army relies very heavily on their immigrant population and their children to fight this war. And on the one hand, it's seen as an opportunity, right? This is the opportunity to be to show their loyalty and dedication to the United States. And some of these, both in German, you know, those from German states and those from Ireland, fight very valiantly, and in the especially they fight in ethnic brigades. So there's the Irish Brigade under the leadership of General Marr, and there are also German American brigades that are fighting. So on the one hand, it's a moment for inclusion because they hadn't always been very accepted, and they saw this as a chance perhaps to gain greater acceptance. On the other hand, not everybody fought. Many, as they said at the time, skedaddled. They did not want to fight in a bloody war, some of them that they felt wasn't really their fight.
Well, they just got here.
Some of them just got here, and there's even there are stories of people, you know, being immigrants being recruited at the docks for the army. On the other hand, there's a growing sense of resentment by the end of the Civil War that the immigrants had, in some ways, perhaps not done more than their share, but that their participation had not been fully recognized. And the Irish in particular, who they suffered incredible losses in the battles. The Irish Brigade is really decimated. And once the draft goes into effect in 1863, they are bitterly, their support for the war tempers because especially they feel like it's the Union Army just wants their bodies and that the rich and the native-born are being able to pay their way out of the army, and they cannot. Because you could, for the conscription, if you paid a fee, you could hire a substitute.
Wow, so they felt like they were being used basically as cannon fodder.
Exactly. They did. And so at the end of the war, as they are limping home, they are on the one hand very proud of their service, but they're very determined that their service should be recognized and that they should be treated with greater respect than they are.
And that affects their feelings about their new U.S. citizenship, Lucy. How do they express that feeling?
Well, they organize. They're very involved in politics. They're determined that their place in the new nation should be recognized. Right after the Civil War, it's a really really exciting time in some ways, but it's also very tumultuous. This is the period of Reconstruction. So Congress is sitting down and basically rewriting parts of the Constitution. Not only do we have emancipation, which is huge, but they're redefining national citizenship for the first time. So we have the 14th Amendment, much in the news today, defining, saying that anyone born or naturalized in the United States is a citizen. And there are new laws being passed to protect, to define what rights people have because they're citizens. So the foreign-born are following this, and they, on the one hand, they're supportive, but they also feel that their needs and their concerns are not being addressed by the U.S. government or by Congress, and that a lot of the focus is on the recently freed slaves. And they're thinking about, well, what about us? You know, we have problems. Our citizenship is not secure. And it's especially not secure whenever we leave the United States. We can be claimed by our former homelands. And they want the United States to extend to them greater protection and have their rights recognized.
When these foreign-born new citizens go back to their native countries for business or family reasons, and as we said earlier, some of them get scooped up or are threatened, and that's where this tale really begins. So we'll pick that up after a short break, Lucy, and we welcome your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
NHPR's Leadership Circle is a community of listeners who place a high value on thorough and thoughtful journalism. I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major Giving. As a member of the Leadership Circle, your monthly investment of $100 or a single gift of $1,200 helps us create and deliver the news you trust and the programs you love. Take a moment to think about the essential role NHPR plays in your life and consider deepening your commitment to the station. Give online at nhpr.org/leaders.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a new book from a UNH professor called Under the Starry Flag. It's about a small band of Irish Americans who tried to fight for Irish freedom from Britain and how their efforts resulted instead in major changes in U.S. citizenship policy. We're talking with the book's author, Lucy Salyer. She's an associate professor of history at UNH. And let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, if you have questions about this period of time and especially the role of Irish Americans here. 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Lucy, let's get into the meat of it, the sort of micro story that gets us into this macro story about citizenship and immigration. Who were the Fenians?
Okay, the Fenians were a group of Irish freedom fighters, we would call them. They were a group of men, primarily, although there was a Fenian sisterhood. But they were seeking to make Ireland independent, in essence. So they wanted to revolutionize Ireland, which meant kicking Britain out of Ireland. And it was a transatlantic organization. It had a significant branch called the Irish Republican Brotherhood in Ireland, and then the Fenian Brotherhood in the United States. So they there are about 250,000 of them in the United States at its peak. That's a lot, given
the size of the country at the time.
It is a lot, and a lot more would have empathized or sympathized with the movement if they were not former members. And they were almost all, well, a significant portion immigrated during the famine. And so, like the hero of the story, John Warren. And so they're leaving Ireland with a sense of bitterness. And
maybe they didn't really want to go, and they're extremely angry at Britain.
Exactly. They feel like Britain, the famine was not necessarily just a natural disaster. It was a political disaster that Britain could have done a lot more. So they're immigrants. Lots of them are Civil War veterans. They've been organizing and training during the Civil War. And they believe that the only way to free Ireland is by physical force.
And they know how to fight. They're used to it now.
That's one of the goals about participating in the army, not only to defend the Union, which they definitely believed in, but they were also honing their military skills and the preparation for what they called the next war against England.
Were there Fenians in Canada or Australia or other English-speaking countries, or was it mostly an American and Irish thing?
There are definitely Fenians in Canada. Anywhere the Irish settled, there was bound to be people who sympathized with the freedom of Ireland, and they would be members of the Fenian Brotherhood. But the main two branches were in Ireland and the United States.
You write, Lucy, that the British officials, of course, regarded Fenians as a menace because they're trying to throw off British rule in Ireland. What about American leaders at the time? How do they view the Fenians?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say they view them with caution. I mean, they, on the one hand...
Especially early on.
Yes.
Their feelings right. Shift as time goes on.
Well, they get behind the Fenian cause in the sense of, the bigger cause of the right to leave and change your citizenship, because it's not limited just to the Irish. But they definitely support the Fenians to some extent, and they really, by that point, by the end of the Civil War, the foreign-born are becoming an increasingly important political power. They are naturalized citizens, and that means they can vote. And in this tumultuous political climate during the post-Civil War period, both parties are actively seeking votes. So that's one reason that they're, you know, paying attention to what the Fenians do. And so even President Johnson is and Secretary of State Seward are responsive to the Fenians cause without. But that's a tricky line because they can't explicitly condone the Fenians. But they invade Canada. And so that is also tricky because if they condone that, they're violating neutrality laws.
And Canada at this point is still British controlled.
Exactly. So they do support them, but they're try not to support them too much so that they run into difficulties with foreign policy.
Sure, because how do they do that? I'm sure the British regarded the Fenians as what we would call today terrorists. They're trying to overthrow a government through use of violence.
Right.
So if you're British, you think, America, I thought you were my ally. Why are you supporting these terrorists?
Well, this is true, although Britain and the United States were not particularly cozy after the Civil War either.
True enough. And there's that War of 1812 thing as well. Yeah.
Yes. So this is Britain and the United States were not in the place they were in the 20th century, let's put it that way. And right after the Civil War, there's a lot of discord between Britain and the United States. A lot of Americans are very angry with Britain for their actions during the Civil War. They felt they had been much too sympathetic to the Confederacy. They had recognized, they had declared neutrality early on in the war, which in essence meant they recognized the South as a legitimate belligerent rather than as rebels. They also allowed Confederate ships to be built in English ports, and especially the notorious Alabama, which was a raider, a ship that attacked the Union the Union Navy and also merchant ships and did terrible damage. And many Americans thought by allowing that to happen, they had allowed the war to continue much past. It might have ended much sooner if the British had been less supportive of such endeavors.
That's a really key point, and that's a point that I had forgotten mm-hmm. until I read this book. Obviously, we learned the Civil War in school, but you're right, Lucy. Why would America really care how Britain feels about American support for these Fenians when Britain had, as you said, declared neutrality during the Civil War, mm-hmm. basically really hurting the Union cause?
Right, exactly. And it also feeds into, the relations between Britain and the United States had been tense for quite some time off and on. And Charles Francis Adams, who is the son of John Quincy Adams and the grandson of John Adams, both presidents, he's the foreign diplomat in England at the time. And he says, the British seemed almost gleeful, or at least some of them, like the foreign minister, Lord Palmerston, who had been active during the War of 1812. They said, he seems gleeful almost that the Great Republic will finally have broken down, right?
They had gleeful that the Civil War had been entered.
Right. That, they're a little bit annoyed by how successful the United States has become.
Well, from their selfish perspective, it makes sense because you have this emerging great power on the other side of the Atlantic mm-hmm. rivaling you. You're a great power. So if that emerging great power breaks in two, all the better for you
exactly.
and your own power.
Exactly.
But I had forgotten about that point. It's really interesting. Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We want your questions and comments about this fascinating period of history and how this group of Irish Americans joined a movement called the Fenian Revolt. And in so doing, as Lucy says, sparked a crisis over citizenship in this country. We'll hear about that in just a moment. We welcome your comments and questions. Our email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Lucy, you set the table. American officials say, okay, we don't mind these Fenians, especially if they annoy Britain, because Britain hasn't really been our best friend lately. Your book begins with the men who try to go over to Ireland and help Ireland win against Britain. They get a boat, they get weapons, they get money, they sail over, they have grand plans to help out this Fenian revolt. Who's in this group?
It's about 40 to 45 men on the ship.
Not a lot of people.
No, it's a...
to help with a revolt against a major power.
I know. And so it's always the British or the press in Ireland and Britain are always scratching their heads over, did they really think they were going to take on the British Empire with this little gun-running expedition? You have to admire their nerve, I have to, you have to say.
Their pluck.
And their pluck, they're a little bit, they might be a little deluded, but they also have a lot of dedication to the cause. And so what sparks this particular expedition, it becomes known as the Erin's Hope Expedition, is there's a rising finally in Ireland in March, on March 5th, 1867. And so the Fenians have been plotting a rebellion in Ireland for years. And people keep waiting, and never comes about. And finally, in New York, they hear news that the rising has finally happened. And there's a great deal of excitement in New York City and elsewhere. And so the Fenians come together to decide how to respond because they're getting requests from Ireland for help. And so they want arms and they want men. And so they find this pretty rundown brigantine called Jackmel, and they fit it up to so it can sail across the Atlantic. And they have about 5,000 revolvers and rifles and 3 pieces of artillery, 1.5 million rounds of ammunition in the hold of the ship. You know, they're all packed up in piano boxes and sewing machine cases to disguise them.
Yeah, they have to be sneaky about it.
Yeah, they're not, and they don't have permission. You have to, they don't have papers to sail and legally, and they're flying flags that aren't theirs. They're sometimes flying the Union Jack to escape detection.
Wow, they have a couple of fake flags that they run up
yes.
the flagpole just in case.
Exactly. So this is definitely not a legitimate and, you know, legal-wise expedition. So, but the guys on board are really an interesting mix. On the one hand, you have John Warren, who is born in Ireland in County Cork, in Clonakilty. And he had come over in 1853. He was only 19 as an Irish immigrant. And he had served in the Civil War. And he had become a sort of a mid-level Fenian leader. And then you also had William Nagle as another co-commander. And he's born in the United States. His father claims to be a famous Irish rebel, part of the Captain Rock movement that had done a lot of damage earlier in Ireland. So you have people like that, and they tend to be basically what we might call upper working class and lower middle class. They're tradesmen, shoemakers and tailors and laborers, clerks that work for the government. Warren himself owns a grocery store and liquor store in Charlestown, Massachusetts, and he's also a journalist, which is a really important fact because he's really good with his words.
He does a good job with his words, convincing Irish Americans in particular and Americans more broadly that this is a just cause, and we'll get to that in just a moment, because he goes over, he and the others, they're arrested by the British, they're thrown in prison, and then they say, hey, Britain, you can't do this. We're Americans.
Exactly.
And what do the British say?
They say, you're not Americans, or at least people like Warren are not. They're willing to recognize native-born Americans as American citizens. But to the majority who are naturalized American citizens, they say, you're a British subject because you're born in Ireland under British jurisdiction. You'll always be a British subject.
Which sounds crazy for people like John Warren, who had been in America for a while, who had fought and could have easily right. died in the Civil War, who owned a business, who had a family. Go ahead.
Yes. No, absolutely. And that's what he says. I left Ireland. I renounced my allegiance to the Queen. Very delighted. You know, he talks about having broken the shackles of slavery. British slavery when he became an American citizen. So they say, no, we are American citizens and we can choose to be American citizens. And the British just say, nope.
So there were 40-ish of them on that boat?
There were about between 40 and 45, if you include the crew, and about 32 actually land in Ireland.
And do all of those 32 get thrown in jail?
They all get thrown into jail. Right. And some are in Sligo, but most of them are in Kilmainham Jail in Dublin.
How does the American government react?
Well, they respond and try to defend them to some extent. They immediately write to the consulate. They're writing to Charles Francis Adams.
This is where their ability with words comes in. They wrote some very persuasive letters and articles and opinion pieces.
Yes, they did. And so the government and they're demanding that the government intercede on their behalf and to free them. The government they respond and they say, why are they being held? And this increasingly, the government at first is really trying to keep a lid on this, especially Charles Francis Adams. He does not want diplomatic relations to
be ruptured.
Again,
he's the ambassador.
He's the foreign minister, the U.S. minister in London. And he's been there all through the Civil War, and he just wants to go home in the worst way. And he's been trying to keep Britain and the United States at peace since 1861. And his goal is, let's keep a cap on this. William Henry Seward is Secretary of State. And while he doesn't necessarily want a war, he's willing to use this issue as a leverage against Britain because he's trying to negotiate other issues. And so he is alternately kind of feisty and defending, you know, saying, you know, they are American citizens. You should let them go and treat them better. And then, you know, trying to resolve it without it turning into a war.
How does the American public react to this imprisonment of these Fenians, especially the Irish American public?
Well, they are furious. And this seems to, and not only the Irish Americans, but foreign-born Americans that
in are general.
In general start to protest. Because what happens is that it really starts to, it strikes a chord with naturalized Americans that they feel the United States government isn't doing enough, right? Even if they're doing something, it's not enough. And they are just really thinking, this shows that we're second-class citizens. Why isn't the government busting down the doors, you know, and what does it mean to...
Especially after we fought during the Civil War.
Exactly.
These large groups of Irish and German and so forth.
Yeah, they'll say that often. They'll say, I have scars on my body from the Civil War. I put my life on the line. I deserve better treatment. So there's been such discrimination against the Irish and immigrants in the early 19th century that they're only, you know, there's still a lot of anti-Irish cartoons that depict them as apes and snarky comments about the Irish that they are very... This seems just typical of the government to dismiss their claims and
use
not protect them enough.
Use my body for your war. Use my body for your factories or whatever. But I can't count on you when I'm in trouble in a foreign country.
Exactly.
Let's just say, though, Lucy, that even though other immigrant communities latched onto this cause and said, yes, you know, I would like to go back and visit my family in France or Germany or wherever, but I'm afraid I'm going to be scooped up by the authorities. It's one thing to go to France for business and visiting family. These Irishmen were planning an armed revolt. So it's a little bit different than, yeah, I could be scooped up anytime, anywhere.
No, absolutely. And a lot of while the Irish and the foreign-born Americans are getting behind this cause, a lot of Americans are not supportive of the Fenians. Charles Sumner, the senator of the the great leader in the Senate of the Republican Party at the time, is, you know, thinks they're just big troublemakers and that they're that the United States is being held hostage in some ways to these causes.
We will talk after a short break, Lucy, how African Americans felt about the Fenian cause and how the Fenians felt about them. Also, Chinese immigrants who are coming in large numbers kind of latch on to this Fenian cause and say, hey, what about us? Even women, as you write, say, well, freedom for them. How about freedom for us? So this little revolt sparks a huge conversation in this country. We will pick up on that after a short break. And we'll hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477.
New Hampshire Supreme Court has said the state must provide an adequate education to every child. What exactly that means is up for debate.
You're confusing what the definition of an adequate education is and what school districts are actually spending for bells and whistles.
People are really at the end of a road here that I think needs a change.
I'm Sarah Gibson. Listen for Adequate, a new series about how the state decides the value of public education. Thursdays on Morning Edition, only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, mental health parity, what it's supposed to mean and what actually happens in practice. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, how Irish-American involvement in an Irish revolt against British rule called the Fenian Revolt sparked a giant debate in the U.S. on what it means to be an American citizen. Let's get your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guest is the author of a new book. It's called Under the Starry Flag, How a Band of Irish Americans Joined the Fenian Revolt and Sparked a Crisis Over Citizenship. Lucy Salyer is with us. She's an associate professor of history at UNH. And Lucy, you mentioned how other foreign-born, naturalized Americans felt about this Fenian cause, how these Irish Americans were thrown in jail in Britain. German Americans, French Americans, Americans from other European countries said, yeah, this is kind of our cause too. And do more for us, America. We've done plenty for you already. What about newly freed slaves, African Americans? How did they see all the furor or uproar or discussion about the Fenian Revolt?
It's hard to know in detail what they thought about the Fenians in particular, but they certainly would have supported the freedom, this idea that people should have the right to move about and to become citizens wherever they like, because that was the main thing that they were seeking as well, right after, well, even before the Civil War. Free blacks, and obviously slaves, but free blacks too had suffered a lot of restrictions on where they could go. Like, some states didn't allow them to enter into, you know, there were bans on the in-migration of free blacks. And in the Dred Scott decision of 1856, the U.S. Supreme Court had said that free blacks are not citizens of the United States. So these questions of citizenship and the freedom to move about, and importantly, the protection that you're going to be protected wherever you go by the government, they're as dear to African Americans as they are to foreign-born Americans.
You mentioned earlier, Lucy, that the Fenians use some of the language of slavery. We're going to help Ireland free itself from the shackles of slavery. Mm-hmm. That's the language that the Fenians used. But was this group of Irish Americans, or Fenian sympathizing Irish Americans in general, were they feeling brotherhood with the cause of newly freed slaves and free blacks?
Not particularly, although it also varies. John Warren and William Nagle are actually unusual amongst, they are the two leaders of the Aaron's Hope expedition. And they're some of the people who are writing a lot about this. They do not make distinctions about, you know, on the basis of race. They will very much talk about this cause, you know, themselves as being the slaves of England and the need to, just like African Americans are being afforded protection by the U.S. government against states, you know, this the 14th Amendment guarantee of equal protection under the law. So they'll use that same language in arguing for new legislation for foreign-born. Warren, though, makes common cause with other groups. So in his newspaper, The Fenian Spirit, he will praise the fight of the Maoris in New Zealand against the British. They had had a rebellion, and they had been quashed. So he sees all people seeking freedom as being united. Unfortunately, he's not probably typical of most Irish Americans living in the United States. And more typical are arguments that really play up the race card, so to speak. So there's one crazy speaker that speaks at a lot of rallies for the Fenians called George Francis Train. And he was a really popular speaker. He was a self-made man. And in 1867, he's speaking on behalf of both women's suffrage and the Fenians. And when he goes before a crowd in Boston of Irish Americans, he'll basically say, you know, Irish are white men who have no respect from Congress. All that Congress cares about are black people. And he'll say, you know, use worse terms than that, but he's basically stoking the fires amongst Irish Americans to say Congress only cares about African Americans. They do not care about white people. And there is a huge backdrop here in Reconstruction that race is really still framing debates over citizenship. Should newly freed black Americans have the same rights as white people? Are European immigrants more similar to white Americans or not? And so part of the argument is that on the part of some of the European-born is that they should deserve greater, they needed greater attention from Congress because they're being left out of the equation and all the rights are going to Black people. So race plays an unfortunate role, and it already had divided Irish Americans and African Americans to a large extent because in some ways they're both at the bottom of the economic ladder and they're both being treated horribly. And so one way to for Irish Americans to have a leg up is their race.
So I can gain some measure of success if I put down the other guy.
Exactly.
There's more about that in the book, so I won't ask you about it now, Lucy, but it's very interesting, especially this figure, George Francis Train, who really kind of whipped up Irish fervor and spoke, as you said, in a way that encouraged the European-born to not encourage the freedom for African Americans as he was encouraging more freedom and more rights for European-born, especially Irish.
Yes, exactly.
So
one journalist said that he had diarrhea of the mouth. People showed up just because he would say the craziest things, but also very inflammatory things.
Well, I'll set that aside for the moment, but there's a lot more in the book, and it is really interesting. But in the midst of all this, all these sort of cultural debates and political debates over who's a citizen, immigration, who gets what out of Congress and the national government, comes Chinese immigrants, as you write, Lucy, arriving in very large numbers on the West Coast at that time. So how do these Chinese immigrants hear these Irish American arguments? We deserve to be citizens. We are citizens. We fought for you. We deserve more protection. How do the Chinese tap into that?
Well, Chinese immigrants are coming over at the time. You would think in some ways the Irish would make common cause with the Chinese because they too, China has also been the victim of British imperialism. And one of the reasons why you have such an influx of Chinese immigration is because of the opium wars that had been started by Britain to try to open up Chinese markets and to also to guarantee the free migration of Chinese laborers. They need the British Empire wants Chinese workers to come to their outposts to provide the labor that slaves had in the past. So, but they do not. The Irish Americans do not often make common cause with Chinese immigrants. And it's similar to their position towards African Americans. Again, seeing them as somewhat as competitors for jobs, and also so whiteness gives them kind of a leg up in terms of the hierarchy that exists in the United States. But Chinese immigrants are coming, and they too are seeking, like everybody else, economic opportunity, perhaps a freedom from a very unstable situation, largely created by the British inroads into their country. They succeed in getting recognition of the right to migrate, but they are barred from citizenship. That 1790 law that I mentioned before says that only free white persons could become citizens. Even after a treaty is negotiated, the Burlingame Treaty, that recognizes the right of Chinese to migrate and to leave their homes, when it gets to the Senate, there's a lot of concern that they will be able to become citizens. So they include an amendment to the treaty saying this does not mean Chinese can become naturalized citizens. And in fact, we'll have a racial bar on citizenship until 1952. You had to be white to become a citizen.
It's a long time.
It is a long time. So Chinese immigrants don't benefit in some ways.
Well, in the end, Lucy, the Fenian prisoners are freed. This band of people that went across the ocean hoping to help Ireland free itself from Britain. They're freed. We won't go into the details of that, but there's a lot of celebrating in this country. So what's the impact of that, Lucy, on U.S. citizenship policy? How do things start to change once this whole Fenian revolt issue is somewhat resolved?
It changes in really significant ways. One thing is that the United States finally passes a law that recognizes the right of expatriation. So, and this is, I think, an interesting chapter that we've totally lost sight of. The Expatriation Act is passed a day within the ratification of the 14th Amendment. So in some ways, it's the flip side. The 14th Amendment said anyone born here or naturalized is a citizen. The Expatriation Act says, and you're free to get that up. So in some ways, it's the exit clause. So it says everybody has a natural right to leave their homeland and to change their citizenship, and the United States will protect you in the homeland, whether you're native-born or naturalized. So that's an important victory. And
that's
what
the Fenians wanted.
That's what they wanted. It seemed revolutionary. And that's what the European-born wanted in general. And they saw this as their reconstruction program. But more importantly, probably, are the treaties that are signed. The United States negotiates 13 treaties with various countries. Especially important are the treaties signed with Prussia and other German states and Britain, because they're sending 70% of the immigrants that come to the United States. And in these treaties, those countries finally recognize the right of expatriation, the right of individuals to change their nationality. And this is probably really especially important for the British, because they've held on to this idea of perpetual allegiance. They call it, you know, the ancient doctrine, once a subject, always a subject. And so finally they say, okay, fine, you can go.
Which is pretty astonishing, because you explained earlier, Lucy, how important people in general, but especially, again, young people in their prime working and fighting years in terms of the men becoming soldiers. It's kind of a big deal that Prussia and Britain gave this up.
It is.
It's kind of astonishing.
It is astonishing. And the people at the time called it revolutionary. That said, that is, you know, the Fenians sort of win the battle but lose the war on this front.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Because really what their whole purpose, and they invade Canada, we didn't get into that, but this also going over to Ireland, what they're really hoping, they don't really think, that Erin's Hope is going to conquer Ireland.
Erin's Hope, again, is that little ship with
the ship
40
with
people on board that's going to help Ireland free itself from Britain.
Exactly. What they hope is that they're going to create a huge diplomatic ruckus between Britain and the United States, and maybe there will be a war. And if there's a war, then Ireland will become free, because the Irish are going to be the allies of the United States. This is an ongoing kind of ploy by Irish nationalists to stir up a war. And so what happened, though, in the end, is that instead of breaking the United States and Britain apart, what the Fenians accomplished was bringing Britain and the United States closer together. Because Britain and the United States say, okay, do we really want to go over to war, go into war over these guys? And maybe it's better, given this, you know, they start to rethink, well, this is a different world. People are going to be moving all around. People have modern mass migration. People are traveling for work, for pleasure. And so maybe we need to change the rules of the game in international law. It's going to be better if we carve everything up and it's clear whose is whose. Like, so, and then you're going to be responsible, the United States, for these rambunctious rebels in the future.
So the Fenians got partly what they wanted. They got their guys freed from that terrible prison in Ireland. And they also got recognition that, yes, you are an American citizen. And yes, if you get into trouble abroad, we will come help you. But they did not get Irish freedom, and they did not spark a war between the U.S. and Britain.
Exactly.
Really interesting. Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
I was just going to say, Warren actually criticizes the treaty. You would think that when he came home, he would say, look, we got the treaty. But when he looks at what it really meant, you know, and that the United States and Britain were closer together, that's not at all what he had hoped for.
Well, and more, specifically looking at the Fenians now, Lucy, it seems the U.S. government regards them as troublemakers. They get kind of warning from high-level American officials that if you get into trouble again, we're not going to help you out.
Exactly. So the Department of State becomes very savvy. They work very hard to prevent the United from these sorts of groups from hijacking U.S. foreign policy in the future. So in that sense, too, it will be more difficult for future groups, nationalist groups like the Irish nationalists, to use America in that similar kind of way.
What's the last stand of the Fenians?
Well, in 1870, the Fenians have come to mean like Irish nationalists in general, but in 1870, they try once again to invade Ireland. And they go up through St. Albans, Vermont, and they have a battle in Eccles Hill, which turns out disastrously. The Canadians are totally prepared. They have a spy that has infiltrated.
Someone tips them off, yeah.
Yeah, he has wormed his way into the leadership of the Fenians, and he warns them. So they face a phalanx of troops, and basically it all crumbles. There will be a joke that IRA, Irish Republican Army, stands for I Ran Away, because the Fenians fall apart.
And are the Fenians the forefathers to the IRA?
They are indeed. So there will be many. The Fenians disappear, but the Fenian spirit lives on, one could say, and many subsequent groups, but especially the Irish Revolutionary Army is the direct descendant.
I have to ask you one last question, Lucy, and it's less about the Fenians and this whole immigration policy that you researched that's so interesting. But while you were researching, it's clear that you spent some time in Ireland from the way you described the villages and so forth. What struck you from that trip, Lucy, going to the source of the rebellion and the source of so many immigrants to America?
Well, I have gone to Ireland several times, and I've been to Clonakilty, which is a really lovely town in southern West Cork. I think what struck me is how alive the issue is for people there. They always have some relative that lives in the United States. But whenever I said I was working on the Fenians, in the United States, nobody knows who they are.
No,
usually.
I had not known until I read this book. So
unless you know about some history, most people don't. But everybody knows who they are in Ireland, and they're very enthusiastic if you're studying them.
What sorts of reactions did you get from people when you said, "Hi, I'm not Irish. I'm a professor from UNH, and I'm writing a book about this Fenian revolt"?
They welcomed me, and they worked hard to help me find details about their lives. But I would never tell them I wasn't Irish.
It's really nice to meet you, Lucy. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
That's Lucy Salyer. Again, she's an associate professor of history at UNH. Her brand new book is called Under the Starry Flag, How a Band of Irish Americans Joined the Fenian Revolt and Sparked a Crisis Over Citizenship. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and Ali Oshinsky. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.